Okay. Oh, wait, it'll start. People asked me what exactly I was going to be speaking about, the title Six Powerful Women. So, you know, there's the story behind every successful man, right? Stan's a surprise mother-in-law. Stan's a successful a woman who enabled him. So we talk about, coming up soon in a week or two, we'll be discussing the learning the stories of Moshe Rabbeinu, one of the greatest Jewish leaders ever. And we look, and we told only very few things were told about Moshe before Hashem picks him to be the leader and the redeemer of the Jewish people. We have three stories. What are the three stories we know about Moshe? So, first of all, he grows up in the Egyptian palace and he sees two people fighting, right? So he stops. He stops a fight between two people. We just started. The second story that we have about Moshe is after the two fights is that. I'm sorry, before that we saw an Egyptian taskmaster was beating him, right? That's the first story. An Egyptian taskmaster is beating a Jew. So Moshe Rabbeinu gets involved. The second story is the two Jews fighting. And then because of that, he has to run for his life because he killed the Egyptian. He goes to the Midian. And there he finds that these poor men, Yitro, his daughters, are being mistreated. So he gets involved over there. So basically the three stories we have before Hashem appears to him is that he's a leader. He's concerned and he wants to stop fights. Fights between two Jews, fight between a Jew and a non-Jew, fights between two non-Jews. He's a peacemaker. So that's the Moshe that we have. But I want to share with you, really what tonight we're doing is based upon an essay that's Rabbi Jonathan Sacks. He was the former chief rabbi of England. In the first source, he says a beautiful idea that the Torah is a deep and subtle book, and it doesn't always deliver its message on the surface. Just beneath is another and far more remarkable story, not about a hero, but about six heroines, six courageous women without whom there would not have been a Moshe. So that's what we're going to talk about. So if we could figure out who are the big six, who are the six women, don't look on the sources, let's figure out, who are the six women that went into making Moshe Rabbeinu into a leader? Who are they?
Rachel.
How did Rachel? Yeah. So Rachel's before him. She's dead already before Moshe is born.
Pharaoh's
daughter, right? She rescues him from the Nile River. Good, that's one. His mother's sister. Yocheved is his mother. Miriam is his sister. Three more.
His wife,
Tzipora. Good. And the last two are the midwives, Shifra and Pua, the two women who helped save. I have the sources in front of you, but before we actually get into the source, let me show you a quote in the next source from Rabbi Shlomo Aviner. We're good. We're going to discuss about that. What's the identity of these women named Shifra and Pua? There's a lot of discussion between the commentators as to what is the identity of those two women. Correct. So for our purposes, I guess we'll count them as separate individuals, but we'll see. Not everybody necessarily agrees to that. Hi, welcome. So he writes in the second source, most women do not hold obvious positions of authority. However, their roles hidden from sight are no less important. Right? You know, people think that, oh, because the men are in the spotlight, they must be there more important. Not at all. The sovereignty of women is hidden. He quotes the verse, the honor of the princess emanates from within. Kol klud bas melech panima. This idea of being modest. This type of sovereignty wields an influence on historical events through the strength of their personalities. So as we're going to go through, and we'll see these six women and what they were able to do and the strength of character of each one of them. So the first one, just a few sources with the verses, is chapter 1, verses 15 to 17. The king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew wives. One was named Shifra, and the second was named Pua. And he said, when you deliver the Hebrew women, you see on the birth stool, if it's a son, you shall put him to death. But if it's a daughter, she may live. So physically, he says, kill the boys. And it sounds like the girls are off the hook. If a daughter, she may live. But Paro was not a nice guy. Paro had a plan for everybody. The boys, he wanted to physically destroy them by killing them. That's how you physically would destroy them. But it says, the daughters that she may live, though this was part of his decree against them, that the daughters were, well, we just started a few minutes ago. The daughters are to be living, but not living as regular people, to be living as Egyptians. In other words, this is assimilation. What Paro was trying to get to do was to cause the boys physical death. The girls, a spiritual death. Cause them to live, but in parentheses you have to add in, live like an Egyptian lives. Intermarry, etc. The midwives who feared God, and they did not do as the king of Egypt spoken, but they enabled the boys to live. So okay, so we see two remarkable women, Shifra and Pua. We'll get to their identity in a little bit. Another in the next chapter, two. Now, look closely, because there's no names here. A man from the house of Levi went and married a daughter of Levi. This is going to be Moshe's parents, but there's no mention of their names. The woman, again, we don't know who she is, conceived, bore a son, and when she saw that he was good, she hid him for 3 months. When she could no longer hide him, she took him in a reed basket, smeared with clay and pitch, placed the child into it, and put it in a marsh at the Nile's edge. His sister stood from afar. No names to know what would be done to them. Maya Aselo, what's going to be done to him? Okay, Paro's daughter. No names yet. Now, her name, it's interesting. In the Chumash, it's written Bitya. But no one really pronounces that. Everyone pronounces it Basya. Batya. So we'll be incorrect, but at least we'll be safety in numbers. We're going to pronounce her name wrong. We'll call her Batya. Paro's daughter went down to bathe in the Nile. So question that jumps out. What do you mean? She didn't have any, there's no spas in the Egyptian palace. She had to go to a river to go bathe. So we'll talk about that. And her maidens were walking along the Nile, and she saw the basket in the midst of the march. She sent her maidservant and took it. Commentaries discussed, is the maidservant really a physical person, or was it her arm itself that she stretched out to take it herself? Paro heard the incident, he saw it. Okay, I'm skipping a little bit. These are for more. This is after Moshe. We said that he saw the Egyptian beating the Jewish person, so Moshe killed him. Paro heard of the incident, he sought to slay Moshe, so Moshe fled from Paro. He stayed in the land of Midian and sat down by a well. It's a good singles place to meet a girl, the well. Now the chief of Midian had 7 daughters, okay? And they came and drew water, and they filled the troughs to water their father's flocks. The shepherds came and drove them away. So Moshe rose and rescued them and watered their flocks. So again, here you see this idea of Moshe getting involved, one of the characteristics of a leader, that he doesn't let, he cares about people who are being oppressed, people being afflicted. But I skipped that, right? They came to their father, Reuel, and he said, why did you come home so quickly today? And they replied, they don't know who he is. They say, an Ish Mitzri, an Egyptian man, rescued us from the hands of the shepherds, and he also drew water for us and watered our flocks. So this man, Reuel, Yitro, he's a smart cookie. He says, what do you mean? He says to his daughters, where is he? Why did you leave him? Invite him and let him eat bread. I got 7 girls to marry off. Here's a nice Jewish boy. Why did you just leave him out there? So Moshe consented to stay with him, and he gave his daughter Tzipora to Moshe. She bore him a son and named him Gershom, for he said, I didn't forget my sources. I didn't forget where I come from. I was a stranger in a foreign land. So these are some of the verses. We're going to talk more about each one of these. But again, the six women that form Moshe Rabbeinu. So number 1, Shifra and Pua. Number 2 is Yocheved, his mother. Number 3 is Miriam, his sister. Number 4 is Batya, Paro's daughter. Did I skip one? Number 4, 5 is Batya, and the 6th one is his wife, Tzipora. So now we'll try to go a little bit about each one of these. Time permitting, we'll see how much we can get in. We'll talk about Yocheved first of all. So let's go back and talk about the first Jewish man and woman, Abraham and Sarah. How old is Abraham? How old is Sarah when they have a child? Does anyone remember?
100.
He's 100 and she is 90. So the Torah goes into great length and detail talking about what a miracle this is that a 90-year-old woman gave birth to a son. That's a big miracle. Okay. So if we do the math, Moshe's mother, Yocheved, was 130 years old. And yet the Torah doesn't mention it at all. There's no big deal. It's just kind of like you have to figure out. You have to look in a Ramban. It gives you a whole way of making out the calculations to come out to the date of 130. Why isn't it mentioned? So if you look, Yocheved gave birth to Moshe at a very advanced age. The Torah describing the marriage of Moshe's parents doesn't record their names. Why does it identify who the two people are? It's the Ramban, one of the medieval commentators in Spain. He says, at this point in the narrative, the Torah didn't wish to interrupt the lengthy description of Moshe's lineage. The main objective now, at the beginning of the story, was to relate the birth of Moshe and who would lead the nation in its redemption. So Rabbi Joshua Hoffman has an interesting insight to this, about to why the names are not mentioned. He quotes, I'm not familiar with this person, Rabbi Dr. Levi Meir, in his book, Moshe, the Prince, the Prophet, writes, the Torah specifically did not want to mention Moshe's lineage in order to show that Judaism does not view its leaders as necessarily coming from extraordinary backgrounds. They can come from humble beginnings and still attain greatness. Similarly, in the Sefer Oznayim LaTorah, Zalman Sirotzkin says, every Jewish child that's born has the possibility of becoming a leader of his people, provided his parents have the proper dedication to God and selflessness that Moshe's parents had. So you think about it, the Torah is giving us a fantastic lesson here. You know why it just starts off? You look at the Pesukim again. The verse said, a man from the house of Levi went and married a daughter of the house of Levi. You know why there's no names? Because it doesn't matter who the parents were. It doesn't matter. They happen to be the leaders of the generation. His father was Amram, who was the leader of the Jews at that point in time. But that's not important. How do I know it's not important? Because the Torah doesn't even tell me who his father is. To show many lessons, but one of them is important, that it doesn't matter. A person might think, oh, I'm defined by my circumstances. These are who my parents were. This is the neighborhood I grew up in. This is the type of education I had. It is what it is. Comes to Torah and says, no. No one's defined by that. No one's limited by that. Anybody can become great. The Rambam writes that anybody can become as righteous as Moshe. Anybody can do that. We have to work. Statistics don't work out that way. We haven't had too many Moshe Rabbeinus over the years. But it's possible. That's an important thing. As a side point, another interesting, some of the commentators discuss why here it mentions that a man took a woman, had a birth. This is a direct refutation of Christianity. Our Savior, the Goel, the one who redeemed the Jewish people, is not there's no immaculate conception over here. He had human parents. So they point that out as well. But I think this idea that Rabbi Hoffman is sharing is important. That Yocheved is his mother, but it's not so important who his mother was. Now, the fact that she did this, we'll see in a little bit about Miriam, how she got involved in the fact that really, we know Moshe had two older siblings. Right, he had his older sister was Miriam, who was 5 years older than him. His brother was Aaron, who was 3 years older than him. And according to halacha, that the requirement of being fruitful, multiplying, pruvu, that mitzvah is satisfied with one boy and one girl. So after Mr. and Mrs. Moshe, I don't know what the last name was back then. They didn't have taxes and any last names. So Moshe's parents, they had one boy and one girl, and Amram, his father, divorced Yocheved, separated from her. Said, we're done. I'm not bringing any more children into the world. Can you imagine in World War II, a couple saying, I'm not going to have any more kids. Look what kind of world we're bringing them into. I'm not interested. So they divorced publicly. Now when the leader of the Jewish people does something, so everyone's looking to see what he's doing. They're going to follow his actions. So Yocheved went, according to the Targum Yonason, and I think it's in the Bahaloschad, says that she went ahead and married somebody else. Not sure exactly who the husband she took at that time, but she had two sons from that marriage, who show up later on in the Torah, called Eldad and Medad. Eldad and Medad were Moshe's half-brothers, because they had the same mother, Yocheved. So just a side point, that so she, even though she herself was no longer married to Amram, husband divorced her, she went ahead and fulfilled mitzvah with another man as well. Then he takes her back later on. We'll come back to that more. Is that a problem? Says Kodem Matan Torah. Kodem Machzer Grushos, so it would not be a problem at that point in time. That'd be one explanation as to why, yeah. But okay, there are many reasons why it was not a problem for doing what he did, yeah. Miriam, now, let me show you the next one, source number 6. This is from a book I found by Rebbetzin Holly Pavlov. So, the Medrash explains the man went, is not going to say he went from one place to another, changing geographic locations. It means he went from one mindset to another, he changed his opinion. So that's what it means. The man went and took his wife, because he divorced her. Now he's going, he's taking her back another time. Where did he go? This is Gemara in Sota. Rav Yehuda Bar Zvina says he went on the advice of his daughter. Amram, that's Moshe's father, was the greatest man of his generation. Since the evil Paro decreed that every male that was born should be thrown to the river, Amram said, we're toiling for nothing. So he went and divorced his wife. Then all the other Jews went and divorced their wives. So Miriam, at the ripe old age of 5, says to her father, your decree is harsher than Paro's. You're worse than he is. Paro only decreed on the males. You decreed on the males and the females. I mean, if no children are going to be born, so that's on everybody. But Paro said the girls could live. Paro only decreed in this world. You also decreed the next world. Meaning, if a child is born and then they're killed because they're Jewish, so they go straight to the highest levels of Shemayim. The Ramban writes in one of his books that if anybody who is killed because they're Jewish, they go to a level in Shemayim that's even in heaven, that's even higher than Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Paro's decrees may or may not be fulfilled, but you're a tzaddik, you're a righteous man. Surely your decree will be fulfilled. So he remarried his wife, and they all remarried their wives. So an entire change was affected by a 5-year-old girl. Now, there's a lot to talk about just on this, but you see, one aspect is the greatness of Amram. He took Musar, he took a lesson from his 5-year-old daughter. Here he is, the leader of the Jews, the greatest man, and she has a good argument. So you have to be humble. You know, we always think, oh, I can only take advice from people who are greater than me, people who are older than me, people who know more than me. You can take advice sometimes from a 5-year-old. It might have some good things to say to you. If your earlids are open, if you want to hear what people are saying to you, listen to the message. So one important thing, and the implication is clear that Miriam had more faith than her father. He's ready to throw in the towel. And here's Miriam. Now again, Miriam is that little sister. I'm sorry, the big sister. Rabbi Adin Steinsaltz writes a lot in one of his books about that big sister mentality that throughout the interactions with Moshe and his sister Miriam, I have a big sister. So that's, you know, it's an interesting dynamic to have a big sister, right? So you have a big sister, so she's always looking out for her little brother, right? We find them again when it comes time when the sea splits and Moshe leads the men in singing. So Miriam's the one who leads the women singing. Later on in the Torah, when there's a complaint about prophecy, so Miriam complains about her little brother. There's a lot to talk about this. Miriam's message to her father was, "Father, you're not in charge of this world. We are required to do our part as best as we can, but whether we succeed or not, it's up to God. Our job is to make the effort to reach from below to above. We're not responsible for the result. God alone determines whether we succeed or fail, whether or not there'll be existence today or tomorrow. We control our attempts to have a baby, but we can't control the length of its days. That's up to God. We misunderstand our function in the world if we base our activities on what might or might not happen in the future." So that's the philosophy of Miriam. That's the second important person who does. Now we fast forward, because she says this at 5 years old. 80 years later, Moshe led the Jewish people through the sea. The Egyptians were destroyed, and the redemption from Egypt was complete. Miriam rejoiced in saying, because the crossing of the sea was proof that her prophecy was true. Here's this little kid that gets in the river, and she stands, as we saw the verses in the beginning, she's standing at a distance to say, Maya Aselo, what's going to be with my little brother? And there it is. Imagine the faith to wait 80 years to see your prophecy fulfilled. We can't wait 8 minutes. You know, we get like impatient, you know, where you're waiting in line too long, or like the page on the computer doesn't load fast enough. Mm-hmm. 80 years. The patience of that. Miriam rejoiced in saying, because the crossing of the sea was the proof that her prophecy was true. Throughout the bitter exile, by the way, that's what her name means. Miriam is like the word mar, bitter. So she was one who was born in a time of bitterness, right? We were in Egypt for 210 years, but 210 years was not exactly, it was all slavery. There was an intense period of slavery. I didn't have an idea how long, out of the 210 years, how long it was really, you know, miserable, torture. 86 years out of the 210 that we were there, that was when it was really terrible. The rest of it wasn't so bad. But so Miriam was born during that part. Miriam never gave up on life. She never quit. Until the end, she believed we must do our hishtadlus, that's our effort, do our parts, and the rest we should leave to God. So we see Yocheved, we see Miriam, and now I want to go to number 3 and 4, Shifra and Pua. So I'm grateful to a Tanakh teacher at Frisch. The head of the Chumash department is Ms. Yael Goldfisher. So she had these examples that I took from her. Read the first sentence for me. I'm a volunteer. Class participation. So who's going to read the first sentence for me? Susan, go.
The police part?
Yeah.
The police shot the rioters with guns.
Whoa, you're too fast. The police shot the rioters with guns. Where do you put the comma? Anyone, where would you put the comma in that phrase? Where? The police shot the rioters with guns. So the guns belong to the rioters, according to how you put the comma. Okay?
Oh, wow.
How else could you do it?
The police shot the rioters with the guns. The guns belong to the police.
Yeah. So the way you put the comma changes the meaning of it, right? Who has the guns? Let's go to the next one. British history teacher. Okay, Ricky, go.
You want to know what?
I want to know where you're going to put the comma in that.
After British.
British history teacher. So my history teacher is British.
Or after history.
Or it could be it's a British history teacher. Right? Where you put the comma changes everything. Okay, good. Watch this. Here's how we're introduced to Shifra and Pua in Hebrew. Yados ha'ivrios. So, which means they are either the midwives who are Hebrew, or they are the midwives to the Hebrews. If we take one way, and again, Rashi understands that these, the Shifra and Pua, are Jewish. So according to that, these are the Hebrew midwives. That's why Rashi would punctuate the phrase. And it's based upon a Gemara. Exactly their identity. So there's a discussion in the Gemara in Sota that we don't know too many women at this time. We don't have the identities. There is a phrase, a thing they talk about in certain circles called the conservation of biblical characters. So if we know a few names of people, and then we have like another person, we try to match up and say, oh, these two people here, this Shifra and Pua, they're just being called by different names, and it's really two other people we know about. So more or less, we know three Jewish women that names them. We know Yocheved, we know Miriam, and there's a girl named Elisheva as well. Elisheva is the wife of Aaron. So the discussion in the Talmud, if these are really Jewish women, one opinion says it's Yocheved and her daughter Miriam. The other says it's Yocheved and her stepdaughter, her daughter-in-law, Elisheva. So whichever way, the Marsha explains this idea, because we only know three people, and since there's two of them, we have to pick two to put them into this identity. But that's Rashi's approach. Rashi's approach is that they are Jewish. Then there's obvious questions with that. How many people were in Egypt at that time? Hundreds of thousands. What, two women? Are they the nurses? You have two women to give birth to everybody? How could that be? So you say, no, they weren't really there. They were like, they were in charge of it. They were like the head. They were the executives. They were running the hospital. So that's one approach that we understand that they're Jewish. But there is other sources. Josephus says this. He was a historian. There's the something called the Septuagint. You know what the Septuagint is? Septuagint is the Greek translation of the Torah. There's something called the Vulgate. The Vulgate is the Roman translation of the Torah. And by definition, whenever you're translating, it's a commentary as well, because how you choose to explain certain phrases. So in the Septuagint, in source number 7, this translation commentary clearly understands, not like Rashi, but that they were Egyptians. And they would put the comma that these were midwives who were Egyptian. Midwives to the Hebrews. The king of the Egyptians spoke to the midwives of the Hebrews. Right? So they're not Jewish. If you think about this, this is a huge lesson in civil disobedience. Here you have two women, Shifra and Puah, who are ignoring and defying the most powerful person in the world. Now, the question is, though, if we're learning that they're Jewish, so why don't you just say, this is Yocheved, this is Miriam, this is Elisheva, why are they called Shifra and Puah? So we have to know a little bit of Hebrew, what the words mean. In Hebrew, now, modern-day Hebrew, to improve something means, you'd say, lishaper. Lishaper, like the word, you hear the word shofar a little bit, shofar, to improve something is, so that's Shifra. Shifra was the one who liked to improve it. You know, when babies come out, they don't look so pretty. Look all schmutzig, you know, you gotta clean them up, gotta wash them off a little bit. So that was Shifra's job. She would clean up the babies as they came out, you know, all the gunk and all that. I don't even know the technical medical terms, you know, the gunk that the babies come out with. Okay, so she'd wipe off all the gunk. My wife would get upset when she heard me saying the word gunk, but okay, you know all this stuff. So that's the word lishaper, Shifra. And Pua, so like the name sounds, poo poo poo. She used to quiet the baby. She used to, you know, she used to coo them to get them to stop crying. So that was their jobs. So they were Jewish, but they had names based upon what their occupation was, what their function was. Shifra, because she's making them look good, and Pua, because she's cooing them and cuddling them and getting them to stop crying. But if you think about the opposite approach, there are many letters in the Hebrew alphabet that are used specifically with Egyptian names. Pei, a Reish, an Ayin. These are the names. Potiphar, you find when Yosef's name is changed. Tzafnas, Paneach, Paro. You find these types of letters. Ephraim even has these types of letters, sounds in it. So Shifra and Pua are really Egyptian names. So that's the counteract to that. Now if you see in the Shaddal, he's famous. There was a brilliant woman named Nechama Leibowitz. And she wrote very interesting essays on the Torah. And she quotes from a commentary, the Shaddal. He lived in the 18th century in Italy. And I'll read in Hebrew. I'm sorry, I didn't type in the translation, but I'll just read and explain. Ke'ech yitochin. How could you think to say, Shitzav libnos Yisrael, you could tell these Jewish women, lehachris es ko'o b'nei amam, to kill their own people. What kind of Jewish mother is going to kill another innocent kid? It's not going to happen. Right? It's not going to become revealed. So he also explains these must be Egyptian women because it wouldn't make sense to tell a Jewish woman to kill Jewish children. No one's going to listen to that. She's going to tell her friends. She's going to tell her friend. They're going to stop all this. It's all part of a plan to, you know, stealthily kill out the Jewish people. God forbid. So he also learns that these were Egyptian women. So if you look, this is from Rabbi Jonathan Sachs. He says, the significance of this story is that it's the first recorded instance of one of Judaism's greatest contributions to civilization. The idea that there are moral limits to power, there are instructions that should not be obeyed, there are crimes against humanity that cannot be excused by the claim that, quote, I was only obeying orders. This concept, generally known as civil disobedience, is usually attributed to the 19th century American writer Henry David Thoreau and entered international consciousness after the Holocaust and Nuremberg trials. Its true origin, though, lay thousands of years earlier in the actions of two women, Shifra and Puah. Through their understated courage, they earned a high place among the moral heroes of history, teaching us the primacy of conscience over conformity, the law of justice over the law of the land. So now we have four women already. We have Yocheved, Moshe's mother. We have Miriam, Moshe's sister. We have these two women, Shifra and Puah, the discussion about who they really are. But at the end of the day, it's interesting. You just go back for 1 second. Let me show you where we first were introduced to them. It's on the first page. Look at in source 3 again. That last verse. The midwives, however, feared God. Mm-hmm. Throughout the Torah, that's always a phrase when talking about non-Jews. Mm-hmm. Non-Jews talk of Yiras Elokim, of having a fear of God. So that would be perhaps a support as well. But again, either way you slice it, there's strong sources on both sides as to who the identity of them are, but either way, there's powerful messages to be learned. Okay, let's move to the fifth powerful woman, Tzipporah. Tzipporah is Moshe's wife. By the way, what does the name Tzipporah mean? Bird. Okay. So the verses we have about her, we saw that she was given to Moshe after as a wife after he helped out by the well. So later on, after they're married, after God has already appeared to Moshe at the burning bush and told him it's time to go back to Egypt, to Mitzrayim. Now he was on the way in an inn, and the Lord met him and sought to put him to death. This is a very enigmatic story that something happens where Moshe's life is being threatened. So Tzipporah took a sharp stone and severed her son's foreskin. She gives him a bris milah and cast it to his feet. She said, "You're a bridegroom of blood to me." So he released him. Moshe was released. Then she said, Tzipporah says, a bridegroom of blood concerning the circumcision. So a lot to talk about. We have a whole class just on this brief little story. But Rabbi Jonathan Sacks again explains what the idea is that's happening over here. The daughter of a Midianite priest. So again, this idea, this concept that we're not defined by our upbringing, by our parents. A Midianite priest, so her father Yitro worshipped every single type of idol worship, every single avodah zarah there was. And he came to realize that Hashem is the true God. So that's the environment she grew up in. She was nonetheless determined to accompany Moshe on his mission to Egypt, despite the fact she had no reason to risk her life on such a hazardous venture. In a deeply enigmatic passage, it was she who saved Moshe's life by performing a circumcision on their son, right? As we just read. The impression we have of her is of a figure of monumental determination who, at a crucial moment, has a better sense than Moshe himself of what God requires. So there's a concept that women have, the Gemara calls what's called a Bina Yesera. Translated as a higher form of insight than men have. And a fascinating halacha would be as follows. Because women have an insight, it doesn't necessarily mean you can be book smart or facts. Just they understand, they're able to size up a situation. So the halacha is as follows, and I'm getting in trouble, but here we go. If a man brings home a friend, an acquaintance, and the wife says, "I don't want this person in my house." I says, "Why? What's wrong?" She says, "I can't put my foot on it. I can't put my finger on it. He's bad news. He's a bad apple." The halacha is that man doesn't go back into the house. Why? What did he do? He's smart. He's got a good IQ. He's a wealthy guy. I can't tell you why I don't like him. I don't want him around. So the husband has to listen to his wife. Gemara says she has Bina Yesera. She has an additional level of insight. She's picking up on something that he has no idea about. So here also, that's what Rabbi Sacks is pointing out, that Tzipporah knew what to do in this situation. She had some form, again, a huge story, we can't really do much justice to it, but something's going on here, that Moshe's life is in danger. Tzipporah is the one who understands what needs to be done. Actually, just a quick side point, from this, some of the sources bring a proof in the discussion, could you have a female be a mohelet? Or does a man have to be a mohel? So some bring a proof from the story of Tzipporah. She's the one who gives the bris to her son. So it's a machlokas Raman in Mechaber. But yeah, an interesting point. Okay, another one from the book by Rabbi Shlomo Aviner. He says, Aviner, Chazal relate, Chazal meaning our rabbis from the Talmud, he quotes a Medrash. When Moshe arrived at Yitro's home, Moshe told him of the events leading up to his arrival in Midian, meaning that I saw an Egyptian man, he was beating a Hebrew, so I killed the Egyptian man, I buried him, but they found out I had to run for my life. Yitro, who was loyal to the king of Egypt, threw him in a pit. Huh. This act meant death because there was no food or water in the pit. And yet Tzipporah, Jethro's daughter, dropped food to him over a 10-year period. After these years passed, she suggested to her father the pit should be checked to determine what happened to this person. If he had survived through these years, he must be a great man. Yitro was convinced of his death. They checked and found him alive. Okay? Moshe's survival was attributed to Tzipora's strength. Her action, not explicitly mentioned in the Torah, but it's alluded to by her name, she was like a pure bird, right? A Tzipora, who concerns herself with gathering and providing food. So the Medrash, you read the text, it's not there, but the Medrash, the rabbinic tradition on who she was and what she did, again, a very strong heroine, a powerful woman. And the last, I say the last, the best for last, this daughter of Paro. Now, when we talked about that she stretched her hand, she saw this little basket floating. One of my students years ago asked me a great question. She said, what were they thinking by putting Moshe Rabbeinu in the Nile River? She said, could you imagine going, and this was her question, she said, imagine in 1930s in Germany, taking a Jewish baby to the Gestapo office, saying, here, I have a Jewish child. Here she is taking a Jewish child, who Paro, who's the one who's making this decree to kill, God forbid, every single Jew, and she puts him right in the Nazi headquarters. She puts him right in the Nile River in front of everybody. So, we're going to talk a little bit about what happens over here. There's a beautiful chapter that's usually sung on Friday night. Some sing it before Kiddush, maybe after Kiddush. We sing Shalom Aleichem, we sing it called Eish Eschayil. Are you familiar with this? Eish Eschayil, a woman of valor. So even if there's no woman at the table, we still sing it in honor of the Sabbath Queen, in honor of Shabbos. So there's a medrash that goes through each line in that chapter and describes that every line is referring to a different woman in the Torah. So Batya is also there. The verse says, V'tokum bi'od laila. The righteous woman gets up while it's still night. It says that's referring to Batya. What was Batya getting up in the middle of the night? So Batya knew somehow that the Jewish Redeemer was going to be put into the Nile River. She didn't know when it was going to happen, but she knew it was going to happen. So every night she used to get up and go down to the river to look to see if that was it. So it's a coincidence? It's a coincidence that all of a sudden the day she decides to take a bath, the baby comes. No, she was there all along. She was constantly looking and waiting to have her role in this. So now watch. I'm going to read a few sources inside. The Gemara, it's a Medrash in Source 12. The Holy One blessed you said to him, Moshe is not your son, yet you called him your son? You're not my daughter, but I'll call you my daughter. That's what the name Batya means. Batya, if you translate it, Bat, the daughter of God. So that's not really her real name. Like on the birth certificate, you can say Batya, but that's the name that we call her by. Because no one gets that title. You don't find anybody being called the child of Hashem. And yet here she is. The Nether Medrash in Source 13 says, she was one of the few, there's nine, who were so righteous they entered paradise in their lifetime. So she's like the top nine. It's pretty good. You want to be on that list. She was in the process of converting. Batya was becoming Jewish. And from the greatest place of impurity, from the greatest source of evil, comes the redemption itself. Paro, the one who's trying to destroy, who's looking, all his astrologers have figured out that there's going to be a Jewish child who's going to be destroyed through water. His own daughter is the one who saves and brings out the Redeemer. So I saw this on H.com, which is a wonderful website. The Torah tells us the reason Batya was at the river was to wash herself. Why is that? Again, there weren't any baths in the palace. Of course there were. The Gemara so tells us this was no normal washing. Rather, she went to immerse in the Nile to cleanse herself of the idols of her father. Rashi explains this to me, and she was actually converting to the Jewish people. This is her moment. She's like a mikveh. She's going in and she's going to immerse in the water and she's going to become Jewish. Given the context of the times, that seems like an outstanding act of rebellion against the values and attitudes of the Egyptian nation and Paro, her own father. So we see this idea throughout these powerful women, they're not necessarily defined by their circumstances. So you can say, who am I to do anything? This is my father, this is my tradition, I'm the royal family, I can't change anything. She says, no. She bucks all the tradition. The Medrash develops further understanding the qualities of this unique woman. In the Book of Chronicles, we're told that Batya married a man by the name of Mered. So Mered, the word in Hebrew for rebellion is Merida. So Mered means, his name is Rebel. The guy was a rebel. Medrash tells Mered was none other than Kalev ben Yefuna. The man most famous for being one of the two spies who withstood the arguments of the 10 spies who spoke badly about the land of Israel. Right? We know in Parashat Shlach that Moshe sends 12 people to spy out the land. So 10 of them say not nice things. But two of them stood up to that. One of them was, Yehoshua was one, and Caleb ben Yefunah was the other one. So Caleb ben Yefunah rebelled against what everyone else was doing. All of the 10 were saying negative things about it, and he rebelled against them, so he's called by the name Mered, which means rebellion. So what a shidduch, what a perfect match. Here you have Batya, who rebels against her father. She ends up marrying Kalev, who's called Mered, because he rebelled against his contemporaries as well. Why then is the prophet called Mered, which root means rebel? The Medrash answers, he rebelled against the spies, and she rebelled against the counsel of her father. Let the rebel come and marry the rebel. So it's you know, they're compatible. What's called swipe left, swipe right? They swipe the same direction. They got, there's a good shidduch on J-date. And I think that's such a powerful lesson that this woman called Batya, you go in deeper sources, explain that, if you think about it, called the daughter of God. So what other person in the Torah would you call the daughter of God? Think for a second. You had to pick some other person.
Eve.
Who?
Eve.
Yeah, Eve. Chava. Correct. She was the daughter of God, right? Adam and Eve didn't have any parents. They had Hashem. God created them. So the commentators, we had a class a year or 2 years ago, I forgot already, about reincarnation. So the deeper sources explained that the daughter of Parah was a reincarnation of Chava. Because if you think about it, the two stories are very, very similar. Chava makes a misguided judgment as to what is considered to be truly good in life. She decides on her own what's good, what should be from what she's going to do. And Batya comes and corrects that flaw. The same flaw that was the downfall of Eve, Chava, is what brings Batya up, and she makes the thing. She goes against all of convention, all of... She's a rebel. And because of that, she was, as the Medrash tells us, one of the 9 people who gets into the Garden of Eden, to Gan Eden while she's alive. So you see fantastic things about this. And this is the woman who raised Moshe. So, to bring it all full circle. Yes, we know about Moshe. Yes, he's a man. He gets all the credit. He's in the limelight. But it doesn't mean that he was... No one's... Like they say at the stage, no kid is isolated, right? It takes a village to raise a child. It takes 6 women and their influence to produce a Moshe Rabbeinu. And yes, he's the most famous one. And yes, we learn about him, and you can't turn a page in the Chumash without coming across Moshe Rabbeinu. He's everywhere. Since he's born, he goes everywhere. But as Rabbi Sachs pointed out, this whole class was trying just to develop some of the ideas that he pointed out. There's 6 powerful women who formed him. There's his mother Yocheved and all the lessons that we learned from her. There's his sister Miriam, who never gave up and who had the vision to see things. There's Shifra and Pua, exactly who they are. We could discuss, you know, the different pros of each argument, but whoever they were, they defied the king. And then we have his wife, Tzipor, who has a certain insight to understand what needs to be done in each situation. And finally, Batya, the one who is searching for her own personal path to truth and comes and saves and redeems Moshe from the water and leads him to... Because, you know, it would be a very short book if she didn't take him out of the water at that point, you know what I'm saying? It would be a short Haggadah at that point, you know? But Baruch Hashem, there were 6 women. So thank you, everyone, for coming. Are there any questions? I'll try to leave time at the end for any...
I have a quick question.
Sure. It's interesting. When the Gemara talks about 7 prophetesses, it does not mention her. But she obviously has. She had some level of Nuah. Yeah, but on that list also, you know, Sarah, the wife of Abraham, is not mentioned either. So, you know, she also had insight. So you can get an insight without not making it onto the list. Yeah. Yeah.
In response to that, there were also times where, like Paro had like a dream about like a lot of different people had a lot of different dreams, but they weren't considered prophets either. Like I think one of the times when you can get nebuah and see prophecies is in dreams, and that doesn't make you an official prophet.
That's a good point. The Gemara says that dreams are 1/60th of prophecy.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit like, yeah, very good. Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for coming.